Was appointed president of a bank, and intimidated by all of the new responsibilities, he went to his predecessor, the previous bank president, and he said, "Sir, what has been the secret of your success?" "The secret, young man, is two words: right decisions," replied the older man. "But how do you make right decisions?" said the young man. "One word: experience." "But how do you get experience?" The old man smiled. "Two words: wrong decisions." Experiencing the results of wrong decisions is certainly one way to learn how to make right decisions, but there is a better way. It is the wisdom way. What is wisdom? Wisdom is not experience. Wisdom is not knowledge. Wisdom is not information. T.S. Eliot famously asked, "Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information?" Folks, we have more information at our fingertips today than ever before in human history. But I fear we have less wisdom, far less wisdom. Biblical wisdom is the ability to make right decisions without having to experience the wrong ones. Biblical wisdom is skill at daily living. Biblical wisdom is the talent to make good decisions, good judgment. People with good judgment make good decisions on a daily basis. And the sum of all of those good decisions is a good life. And I don't mean that we're perfect or morally perfect before God. That's not what I mean. I mean a good and healthy life, a wise life. This is what the Old Testament wisdom literature was all about: how to live a good life by God's power and by His wisdom. Some people have wisdom, others do not. And it shows in the choices that are made. I love the scripture passage from James that the Eatons did this morning, because it contrasts worldly wisdom with God's kind of wisdom, and it shows in life. Young David had it without all the experience. Old King Saul did not with the experience. The theme of 1 Samuel chapter 18, where we pick up in our study this morning, is wise living. And principle number one: wise living evokes loyal love alongside success. Verse 1, 1 Samuel 18. "Now it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. And Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and prospered. He was successful. And Saul set him over the men of war. And it was pleasing in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants." All right, David has just killed Goliath in chapter 17. The battle took place near Azekah. And after David defeated Goliath, the Israelite army attacked the Philistines, drove them all the way back to their home cities of Ekron and Gath. It was a great victory for the nation of Israel. Saul's son Jonathan reached out to David, and a strong friendship quickly developed between the two men. Jonathan recognized in David a kindred spirit of courage and faith. The friendship of David and Jonathan is obviously one of the great stories of the Bible. It took place over a period of time, even though we have only one verse here or a couple of verses here that are devoted to it. I think we can Actually, as I suggested when we studied chapter 16, I think we actually should fit chapter 16, verses 14 and following into this section here, somewhere between verses 1, 2, 3, somewhere right in there. I've explained my reasons for that chronology when we studied chapter 16. For now, let's just say that David and Jonathan developed a very close relationship over a period of time as they lived together there in the palace at Gibeah. Jonathan loved David. By the way, that's not sexual love, despite what some today are arguing about this passage. This is not sexual love. This is loyal friendship. Honest, true, pure love. David was the anointed one who would take Jonathan's place on the throne of Israel, but the two were not rivals, they were friends. Jonathan's love was a selfless love, a loyal love that sacrificed his own goals for David. And at some point in their friendship, these are just summary verses, but somewhere in this period of time as they developed their friendship, David must have told Jonathan about how Samuel had anointed him as the next king. Can you imagine telling that to the heir to the throne? God has anointed me king, David must have told him at some point. But Jonathan supports the plan of God, and he supports David and God's choice of David to be the next king. We know that Jonathan understands that choice because he gives here in this passage, he gives his royal robe to David and he gives his armor and his sword and all of those tools. Now, we learned earlier in our study here in 1 Samuel that there were very few people, in fact, likely only the king and his son, Jonathan, who had armor. For the Philistines controlled that whole industry of making armor. And so when Jonathan gives his armor and his sword to David, he is essentially handing over his throne, his power to David. And especially when he gives his royal robe to David, that was the symbol of his right to rule. And he gives all of that up, the right to the throne, in favor of his friend. Now that's love. It is the epitome of selfless love. And the two friends make a covenant together. They make a promise together. They promise loyalty to each other. This covenant will form the basis of their friendship for the rest of their lives. In fact, when they meet in the years ahead, they will repeat aspects of this covenant to each other over and over again as a reminder. Turn to chapter 20 and verse 14 where we pick up Jonathan speaking in chapter 20, verse 14, and he says to David, David, if I am still alive after all of this, will you not show me the loving kindness of the Lord that I may not die? Verse 15 of chapter 20, and you shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies. And Jonathan made David vow again. This is the repetition of his vow. Because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life. Chapter 23, verses 16 and following. And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David at Horesh. This is when David is in the wilderness wanderings. And he encouraged him in God. Thus he said to him, do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. And you will be king over Israel. And I will be next to you. This is the contract. My promise. I'm second to you, David. And you take care of me, David. This is our covenant. And David, and Saul, my father, knows that also. So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and David stayed at Horesh while Jonathan went to his house. He knew this is the power of a promise. This promise is unconditional. When we promise ourselves to someone, when we take a vow, we are promising to be there no matter what. We're promising the future. A promise commits what we cannot know. We cannot know the future, but we promise ourselves to be there anyway. Stanley Hauerwas says, the power of a promise is the power to stick with what I am stuck with. This is a promise. Jonathan and David promised to stand by each other without knowing at that time what that would mean for both of them in the years ahead. They had no way of knowing. The years of wandering for David, the pain of watching his father try to kill his best friend, and the distrust that he must have felt from his father even as he tried to serve his father through all of those years. Yet the promise promises the unknown. That's what a promise is. It promises the unknown. You don't know what's ahead, but you guarantee yourself anyway. The closest thing I can think of to this kind of promise today is the marriage vow. A marriage vow promises the unknown. You don't get to say, well, he didn't meet my needs, she didn't meet my needs. You made a promise. You promised what you never knew. That's your vow, for better or for worse. But I never knew how much worse it could be, God. Yeah, but you promised the unknown when you made the promise. That's what a promise is. Anything less is not a promise. The promise takes away all the preconditions. Says, I'll be there, without knowing what that means. And there's lots of heroes. Heroes of the promise. People who stand for others. The soldier who gives his life for another. The young man who cares for his mother in the nursing home, day in and day out. The young woman who cares for her father in the nursing home, even though he's long since forgotten even who she is, but she's there. It's the integrity of a promise. It's Joe standing by Gloria for 10 years in her sickness. And on we could go even in our own congregation. Heroes of the promise. That's what a promise is. And that's what Jonathan gave to David. Verse 5 tells us David was successful. He fulfilled all that Saul commanded him. And he prospered. David was successful in everything he did. He served Saul well. He kept his commitment even to Saul. Saul set the young teenager over the men of war. The people were pleased with that decision. Saul's servants were pleased with all that David did. David was successful, but here's the thing. His success did not come at the expense of other people. When we can combine love with success, we've got wise living. This is the first test of wisdom then. How do we handle success? David is successful. Many people cannot handle success well. A person gets promoted over others at the company, and that person becomes overbearing and proud. Not David. David replaced Jonathan, but Jonathan still loved David, and David loved him. David replaced generals in the army, but the army still loved David. David was successful, but the servants still were pleased with David. So the ability to evoke love while being successful in whatever we're told to do in life is the first characteristic of wisdom living. To be able to combine those two things is the first test of a wise life. Second principle this morning, wise living provokes jealousy because of the praise. Verse 6, and it happened as they were coming when David returned from killing the Philistine, Goliath, that the women came out of all of the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy and with musical instruments. And the women sang as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands, David his 10,000s. Then Saul became very angry, for this saying displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, but to me they have ascribed thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? Well, say what, you know? You've already lost the kingdom, you were told that. And Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. Jealousy rises very early in life. We're born with the jealousy gene. Sheila O'Connor and her husband were taking their 3-year-old son David and his infant brother Andrew to an air show near Washington, D.C. When they told David they were going to Andrew's Air Force Base, David, always a little jealous of his brother Andrew, retorted indignantly, "It's David's too. The Air Force Base must be mine too. My brother can't get all the credit." Kids, the jealousy gene's already there. It's built into us. It's human nature. It just gets bigger and uglier as we get older. And the ramifications as adults of the jealousy gene are huge, but it's still there. We return here to the beginning of the story to retell another scene. Goliath of Gath is dead. As the army returns from the battle to the palace, the people come out to celebrate the great victory over Goliath. Everyone has heard what David did. Everyone was excited to honor the warriors with a ticker tape parade. And as they pass through each of the cities, the villages of Israel on their way back to Gibeah and the palace, the women would come out dancing and singing, and they gave credit to Saul, but they gave greater credit to David. Saul has slain his thousands, but David his 10,000s. A little exaggeration, but that's what the Hebrew culture was prone to do, but it's a song. Saul is enraged. The jealousy gene erupts inside his mind. David's getting the credit he wanted for himself. Jealousy, you see, is all about comparisons, isn't it? Jealousy compares what I don't have with what you have. And I don't like it. Jealousy cries, unfair. He got the job promotion I wanted. She got the house I wish I could have. Jealousy starts very small sometimes, but it grows bigger than Goliath in our lives if we let it. The key is to kill jealousy when it's small, before it becomes a giant and consumes us. In the 1998-99 NBA basketball season, David Robertson, frequent all-star veteran center for the San Antonio Spurs, learned to share the limelight with the new dominant player of the league, his own teammate Tim Duncan. San Antonio won the NBA playoffs in 1999, and Tim Duncan was the star player instead of David Robinson. Tim Duncan won the MVP trophy of that finals. In Sports Illustrated, Robinson reflects on what it was like for him as a Christian. "I can't overstate how important my faith has been to me as an athlete and as a person. It's helped me deal with so many things, including matters of ego and pride. For instance, I can't deny that it felt weird to see Tim standing on the podium with the finals MVP trophy. I was thinking, man, never have I come to the end of a tournament and not been the one holding up that trophy. It was hard. But I thought about the Bible story of David and Goliath. David helped King Saul win a battle, but the king wasn't happy because he had killed thousands of men while David had killed tens of thousands. So King Saul couldn't enjoy the victory because he was thinking about David's getting more credit than he was. I'm blessed that God has given me the ability to just enjoy the victory. So Tim killed the tens of thousands. That's great. I'm happy for him." Now that's wisdom living. That's wise living. And it nips jealousy right in the bud. That's the way to kill jealousy. The problem is that Saul doesn't do it. He let jealousy eat at him and eat at him until it became an obsession. Saul couldn't stand it that David received the praise he wanted. Now it's important to notice here that Saul did receive praise, didn't he? I mean, it's no small thing. I mean, Saul's killed his thousands. He did receive a lot of praise. They were praising him. He just didn't get as much as David. That's why I say that the second test of wisdom living is how do we handle praise? How do we handle praise? Do we compare our praise with someone else's praise and become jealous? If that happens, we've failed the test of praise. Proverbs 27:21 says, "The crucible is for silver, the furnace is for gold, but a man is tested by the praise he receives." A man is tested by the praise he receives. Praise is one of the biggest tests you face in life. Do you get a big head when you're praised? Do you get jealous because someone else gets more praise than you do? It's the crucible. It's the furnace in which your character will be tested. Tested by praise. We think of a furnace as something that's very painful. Praise is a bigger test of your character than most other things. And mine too. How we respond when people praise us will determine what kind of men or women we are. If we fail the test of praise, God can use us. If we pass, then we're ready for new responsibilities for God. So David passed the test. Saul failed. How about us? How do we handle praise? Someone has said that praise is like chewing gum. Enjoy it, but don't swallow it. There will always be someone who gets more praise than we do in life. So if we cannot handle praise and keep it all in perspective, then we'll become jealous of others, and that will slowly destroy us from the inside out. Jealousy is a cancer. It kills slowly and it kills painfully. Proverbs, again, 14 verse 30, calls jealousy the rottenness of the bones. The rottenness of the bones. It's a cancer. Look at what it did to Saul. Verse 10. "Now it came about on the next day that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of the house while David was playing the harp with his hand as usual, and a spear was in Saul's hand. And Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, 'I will pin David to the wall.' But David escaped from his presence twice. Now Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from his presence and appointed him as commander of 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people, and David was prospering, successful in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. When Saul saw that he was prospering, was successful greatly, he dreaded him. But all Israel and Judah loved David and went out, and he went out and came in before them." God was with him, and David was successful. And now Saul was even more jealous of David. Jealousy leads Saul to attempted murder. The more successful David becomes, the more jealous Saul becomes. Saul had been successful, but not as successful as David. Jealousy is the bitterness of successful people who hate it when someone else replaces them or surpasses them. The more the people loved David, the more Saul hated him. Jealousy is the hate we feel when someone else is loved. The more gifts the people showered on David, the more Saul despised him. Jealousy takes out loans to buy what we don't need, to impress people who don't care. To paraphrase Warren Wiersbe. Remember the story of Mozart's life, told by Salieri in what was a play and then a movie called Amadeus. Antonio Salieri was the court musician in Vienna. He worked hard at his craft, writing melodies that were nice and choral pieces that were fine instrumental works that were good. He knew that God had blessed him, and as a young man, he had prayed fervently to God this prayer: "Let me make music that will glorify you, Father. Help me lift the hearts of people to heaven. Let me serve you through my music." What a prayer for a young man to make. Powerful. Then came the boy wonder, the child prodigy, Mozart. He dazzled the crowds. He played music as if it was second nature to him. Complex melodies came from his dancing fingers. But Mozart was a profligate. He was a ladies' man. He was vulgar, immature, obscene, sinful in every way. Salieri grew green with envy. How could life be so unfair? That's the cry of jealousy. Why should it come so easy for him? I have to work hard at everything I get. The story, of course, continues until Mozart dies in a mysterious death, and Antonio is thrilled. His eyes gleam with joy. His rival is dead. But in the climax, Salieri sits in an insane asylum, crazy, where he curses God for denying him the kind of talent that blessed young Mozart. Where was the prayer? Where did it go? The prayer that wanted to honor God is gone. I curse you, God, because you didn't make me better than him. That's what jealousy does. It destroys us. And the gene of jealousy, if you let it get a hold of your life, even in little things, in the little roots that it takes, guess what? It'll drive you nuts. It'll destroy your soul from the inside out. That is worldly wisdom. It may get you ahead in many ways, but it'll never help your soul. Third principle, wise living faces unfair challenges with integrity. Verse 17, then Saul said to David, "Here's my older daughter Merab. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be a valiant man for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul thought, my hand shall not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him." But David said to Saul, "Who am I and what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be the king's son-in-law?" So it came about at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel, the Maholathite, for a wife. Now Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. When they told Saul, by the way, do you notice how many times we have people who love David in this chapter? So she loved David. When they told Saul, the thing was agreeable to him, and Saul thought, "I will give her to him that she may become a snare to him and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Therefore Saul said to David, "For a second time you may be my son-in-law today." Then Saul commanded his servants, speaking to David, Speak to David secretly, saying, "Behold, the king delights in you, and all his servants love you. Now therefore become the king's son-in-law." So Saul's servants spoke these words to David. But David said, "Is it trivial in your sight to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and lightly esteemed?" And the servants of Saul reported to him according to these words which David spoke. Saul then said, "Thus you shall say to David, the king does not desire any dowry except 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take vengeance on the king's enemies." Now Saul planned to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. When his servants told David these words, it pleased David to become the king's son-in-law. Before the days had expired, David rose up and went, he and his men, and struck down 200 men among the Philistines. Then David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. So Saul gave Michal, his daughter, for a wife. When Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, then Saul was even more afraid of David. Thus Saul was David's enemy continually. So here's the third test. How do we handle conflict? conspiracy, entrapment. The third test of wisdom. What do you do when people are against you? Saul hates David. He sets out to destroy him. David is set up on two different occasions as Saul seeks to trap him into making a mistake. And each time David handles it wisely. Folks, we face conflict. We face people who are against us all the time. Sometimes people will try to trap us unfairly in situations to see how we'll handle it. Maybe at work you are set up in an unfair situation by a coworker or a boss. These unfair situations are tests of wisdom. The way of wisdom helps us handle them with integrity. It's important to be a good testimony even when being unfairly set up by those who hate us and despise us. Or we can sit back and cry out, unfair, unfair, all we want. But God says, let me see how you live this out now. How do you handle this one? Saul has two daughters. He uses both daughters to try and trap David, which is an interesting, I suppose, commentary on Saul's own character, to use his daughters to try and trap David. He uses his oldest daughter first. He offers David her hand in marriage. We're not told specifically what the deal is, but it appears that it had something to do with David proving himself in battle because Saul hoped that he would die in that process. But David responds. He says, I'm not worthy of this. I'm a humble person. I'm not worthy to be your son-in-law. What a politically correct answer. Wise for a young man, still a teenager at this point. By the way, you couldn't serve in the army normally until you were 20. So we know that David didn't start out in the army, but of course, after the victory with Goliath, he is quickly elevated as a teenager. David responds with wisdom. But then Saul learns that his younger daughter, Michal, loves David, and wow, this is an opportunity now. He can use her love to trap David, and it appears that David also responded to Michal with attraction as well. David responds to the second offer by saying, I can't afford it, basically. The dowry that would have to be paid is way beyond what I can afford. And Saul says, I'll give you a deal. You prove that you kill 100 Philistines. Bring the proof back to me and you've got my daughter. And this time David says, deal. Not no deal, but deal. But then David goes out and he, with his men, kills 200 Philistines. I'll do it, but I'll do it twice what you want. He brings the proof back to Saul. I mean, Saul's hope, obviously, was that David would be killed in the process of completing the dowry requirements. But he wasn't. And so Saul gave his daughter to David in marriage. Saul's plan had backfired. David did what he said he would do. He carried out exactly what he said. Furthermore, Saul realized that Michal loved David, would not betray him. So Saul was even more afraid than he was before. He knew what we are told several times, that God was with David in all that he did, and that's the wisdom way. We are told in the wisdom literature that the beginning of wisdom is what? To know God. That's the starting point. David knew God, and God was with him. David was unfairly set up by all these traps, but he handled them with integrity. He took the challenge. He did what he said he would do. He looked even better in the end than he did in the beginning. Remember our working definition of integrity from Stephen Carter's book on integrity. He says integrity requires three steps. We must discern what is right from wrong. We must act on what we see as what is right instead of wrong. And we must say openly that we are doing what we believe. All three are necessary to live a life of integrity. Saul fails the test. David passes. How about us? when we are placed in unfair situations, knowing that there is conflict and maybe someone wants to get rid of us or hurt us in some way? Are we careful to be able to distinguish what is right from what is wrong in terms of how we respond in this situation? And then do we do it? And are we willing to stand for what we decide and say it? That's the test of integrity. The challenges may be unfair, but as a Christian in your workplace, God calls you to live a life of integrity. You may have a boss who hates your faith. You may be the victim of a hateful coworker. But the key is to handle those unfair challenges faithfully and with integrity. Being able to figure out what is right from wrong, doing what is right from wrong, and saying that you're willing to stand for what is right instead of what is wrong. 7-year-old first baseman Tanner Muncie never thought he'd end up in Sports Illustrated, but he did. Playing T-ball in Wellington, Florida, 7-year-old Tanner was playing second base, and the ball was hit to him. He caught the ball. He went to tag the runner as the runner ran from first to second, and the runner was called out. And the umpire, her name was, by the way, Laura Benson, called the runner out, said that Tanner had tagged him. But Tanner immediately ran up to the umpire, 7 years old. He says, "I missed her. I didn't get her. I didn't get him, I should say. I missed the runner." So the umpire reversed her call and said, "Okay, safe. You can stay on second base. T-ball." 2 weeks later, Laura Benson was again the umpire. Tanner was playing shortstop this time. This time, Benson ruled that Tanner had missed the tag on the runner going to third base, and she called the runner safe. Tanner, obviously disappointed, tossed the ball to the pitcher, returned to his position. Benson, the umpire, went to the boy. She said, "What's wrong? Obviously, you're upset about something." Tanner quietly said, "I tagged the boy. I got him this time." So what was umpire Benson's response? She reversed her call. She said, "You're out." And she sent the runner off the field. When the opposing coach saw that happen, what do you think he did? He rushed out onto the field. "What are you doing? Taking the word of the shortstop that he tagged him out?" Laura Benson said, "Yes. If a kid is that honest, I have to give it to him." And she told the coach the story. 7 years old, and she rewarded this 7-year-old for his integrity. Look at verse 30. "Then the commanders of the Philistines went out to battle, and it happened as often as they went out that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul." Wisdom. "So his name was highly esteemed." He was respected, just like 7-year-old Tanner was respected for behaving wisely. Here's the principle. Wise living produces personal respect. Wise living produces personal respect. In their book, Freakonomics, economists Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner point out that one of the first acts of parental power is to name your child. They don't get to name themselves. We name them, right? First act of parental power. So, the case of the Lane brothers comes up because many people, by the way, think that when you name your child, you are sort of, that name carries great significance. So, back in 1958, a baby boy was born. The father, Robert Lane, chose to name the boy Winner. Winner Lane. Now, how could you fail if your dad named you Winner? Right? The Lanes, however, had a second son a couple of years later. And for reasons that nobody knows, the dad named the second son Loser. I don't know what kind of dad names their son Loser, but there was now Winner Lane and Loser Lane in the family. What do you think happened to winner and loser? Did he doom loser to a life of losing? Contrary to all expectations, Loser Lane succeeded. He graduated from college. He later became a sergeant with the New York Police Department. Nobody, however, calls him loser. I guarantee you that. He's just Lou. Just Lou. What about the brother with the can't-miss label? Winner Lane. The most noteworthy achievement of Winner Lane is the sheer length of his criminal record. Nearly 36 arrests for burglary, domestic violence, trespassing, resisting arrest, and all sorts of other things. It doesn't matter what someone labels you. It's what you do in life that matters. It doesn't matter if others try to put you down or set you up for failure. It doesn't matter if your parents didn't treat you right. You have a chance to live wisely. And if we live wisely, we will earn the respect, because wisdom is in the living. James, we heard it this morning. It's in the living of life that you're wise. And if you live wisely, you will earn respect in life, just like Loser Lane. So live wisely, my friends. Live wisely. Father, teach us to live wisely, to live lives of integrity and honesty and truth, love and care, to pass the tests of praise and success and conflict. And we can only do it if we know you and we have your power and strength to live our lives. So help us to do that this week, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.